You're listening to the Deal Farm Podcast with Ken Corsini. Educating, inspiring, and connecting you to real estate deals. And now, your host, Ken Corsini.
Hey, this is Ken Corsini with the Deal Farm on today's Best Deal Ever episode. I am joined by Anson Young out of Denver, Colorado. Anson is actually the owner of Anson Property Group. He's a licensed agent in the state of Colorado, and he's been an active real estate investor for a little over 10 years now. He does a little bit of wholesaling. He does some fix and flip. He does some traditional agent work. He's actually really active on Bigger Pockets. So for you listeners who are active on Bigger Pockets, you may know who he is. In fact, he's got a new book that's going to be published on the Bigger Pockets platform later this year called The Book on Finding and Funding Great Deals. But we're super excited to have him on the show. So Anson, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. I'm glad to have you on. We've got a couple mutual friends. I think we were actually introduced through Brandon Turner. Is that right?
That is correct. Yes.
So you are in out of Denver, Colorado, and been busy at fixing and flipping, wholesaling. You're also a licensed agent, and you've been at it 10 years. You actually got started about the same time I did. I got started in 2005. But I'm curious, when you got started back in 2006, which is really right before the crash, what was sort of the impetus to get you into real estate?
So I was, I take that back. I think about 2004 is when I first got the bug, and then 2005 I did my first deal, but I wasn't doing it full time until 2006. So basically in 2004 my wife and I moved down to Arizona, which was a terrible decision from Colorado, of course, to be close to family. And in that process, it was a transition in my career. I had got laid off from IT, and so I decided, what am I going to do next? Do I go back into IT? Do I kind of double down, or do I find something else? And so a friend of mine gave me Rich Dad Poor Dad right before I left, probably 2 days before I left town. And I consumed that book like crazy. I read the whole thing on the way down there. So we landed in a new city, new place. And I said, you know what? This is a perfect opportunity to just jump into something new. And so that was kind of the catalyst. That book changed my entire mindset about everything that I knew. And so I knew that I didn't want to go back into IT right when I finished that book. And I said, I need to do this now.
You know, what's funny is you're maybe the 10th guy on this podcast who has said the exact same thing, that they read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, changed their paradigm, and they were off to the races in a whole new direction. And even if it was business or real estate, I mean, for the guys that are on our podcast, it's real estate, but it's amazing how many lives that book has changed.
Absolutely. I feel like a broken record, or like I don't have a unique story because of it. But it definitely, like you said, it just goes to show that information can transform people for sure.
Yeah. So you moved to Arizona and then immediately decided to get into real estate?
Yeah, I did. It was, real estate there, as I came to find out, was just, it was a crazy house. It was like 44% appreciation. Just,
oh yeah.
Going like when your hairdresser's talking about flipping houses, you should either jump right in while the getting's good or get right out, because so we landed, and I just started doing everything that I could to learn everything that I can about real estate, what I wanted to do, how to do it, try and learn the market, and starting from zero wasn't easy, but we made it happen. So,
wow. So what did you do to begin? Were you wholesaling, trying to find assignments, or were you buying properties in Arizona?
No, what had happened was I started working with another investor and an agent, and I started going to all the club meetings and cash flow 101 games. I just read Rich Dad Poor Dad, so I had to go down that route a little bit. Right. And I was just trying to latch on to anybody who I could. And I was just doing odd jobs for people. I'd go punch signs in yards. I'd punch, real estate signs in yards for agents in return for learning how to use the MLS or how to comp a property or what makes a good deal or how to find these things. Mm-hmm. And so it was a lot of just trying to figure out everything at once. And I felt a bit scattered, and I definitely was. It, you know, in hindsight, of course, I was all over the map. I was looking at lease options. I was looking at fix and flip. I was looking at rentals, and I needed to probably just pick one and run with it. And what had happened was the first deal that I got was in looking back, it was actually from a wholesaler through my agent friend. We bought it. My wife and I, we were trying to figure out what the heck to do with it. And we were trying to lease option it at the same time we were trying to, you know, just turn around and sell it on MLS, kind of a wholesale deal. And we had no clue what we were doing. So, of course, we kind of fell flat on our face, and we finally looked at each other. We go, well, this thing needs some work. And we've never owned a home before, so why don't we just move into it and fix it up and see what we can do? So our first deal was actually a live-in flip. So we lived there for a year. We sold, and as stars aligned, we sold about 2 weeks probably before the market started cooling off. Wow. And we made about $60,000 on that deal. Nice. And we moved right back to Denver. So
wow, got in and out by the skin of your teeth.
Made yeah, it was
that's great timing.
It was, yeah, it was. I wish I could say that I was smart enough that I actually planned that, but it was just timing.
You know, so much of it's like, because there's so many smart people that, you know, in the mid 2000s, they knew that their writing was on the wall, that everything was going to collapse and their real estate was going to be worth half of what it had been worth. I mean, you're sort of like me, because I got started about the same time, and honestly, it was more, I didn't catch much steam until 2007, 2008, when everybody else had lost everything. I didn't really have an opportunity to buy a bunch of real estate yet. I wasn't kind of far enough along that path where all the other guys a few years ahead of me had. I mean, they had, you know, collected a whole bunch of properties that all of a sudden were upside down and they were losing them, but it wasn't because of anything I knew or did. I just got lucky that the timing was I hadn't acquired any property yet before everything would have crashed.
I mean,
if I'd gotten in a couple years earlier, I'd have been just like everybody else. I'd probably had a bunch of properties that were worth nothing.
That's true. So, that's very true.
Man, the fact that you made 60 right out of the gates on your first house and then moved back to Denver. And, you know, it seems like, obviously, Arizona was one of those crazy bubble markets that was super hot and then crashed really hard. But Denver, it seems like to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, never had a crazy run up or a crazy crash.
Well, we did have a crazy run up, but it was closer to, I want to say 2003, 2004, you know, prices started going crazy. And then through 2006, that was the height. That was like the top. So while Arizona was crashing, Colorado was peaking. And then definitely through all the way through about 2010, you know, things were going down. And there was, you know, we weren't like Vegas or Phoenix or Miami or those Sun Belt markets where things just, you know, crash through the floor. But, you know, here we definitely were seeing, like, for example, I bought a house in 2006. Right when I moved back to town, I bought a house for us to live in. And prices went, you know, I bought for about $230,000. And for a time there, you know, the house is actually worth about $160,000 at the bottom of the market. And we didn't regain our value back up to $230,000 until 2011, 2012. So we did, you know, we did see a dip, but it wasn't like a, you know, a plane nose down into the mountain dip.
Yeah,
so
yeah. And did it recover fairly quickly too? And now you guys are well above, you know, where you had been previously, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That recovery was, you know, 2011, 2012, people probably were no longer underwater. And then we've seen a good 10 to 12% appreciation since then. So things are going very steady, very strong here.
Yeah, that's a good market. So you're in a, what seems to me like is a pretty competitive market. What's sort of been your business model then for the last several years?
So it definitely is competitive. Right now, inventory is just really low. I think it's below a month of inventory. And it's, you know, it obviously creates an insane seller's market.
Absolutely.
And, you know, investors, we might have the same amount of investors, but now we're fighting over a smaller pool of deals, or seemingly, especially if you're buying just off of MLS. But, and then, so my business strategy has been, I was wholesaling pretty much exclusively through about 2012. And right when the market tightened for buyers is when I decided, you know, I kept looking at these deals and I said, well, I can wholesale it for 5 or 10, or I can hold it and flip it and make, you know, 20, 30. Now that deals are becoming more scarce, I'm going to go back to a fix and flip model. So I went from exclusively wholesaling to going back into the fix and flip world when deals were becoming scarce and I had less on my desk, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, especially if you see, you know, inventory getting down to 1 month levels, you know, you're in a seller's market. I can imagine as a wholesaler, that's hard to see these other guys that are these investors buying deals from you, making these nice big rips. And you're like, man, why am I not doing that?
That was exactly the conversation in my head was, wow, I'm like leaving all this money on the table. And I know how to fix and flip. So I am just going to jump back into it and start fixing and flipping again. So
you're also a licensed agent, right?
I am.
And so when did you get your license?
I got my license in 2006. Okay. So right when I moved back to town, I basically was getting my license just as a, you know, as a tool so I can have MLS access. I thought for, you know, a little bit that I might want to just go into be a real retail agent. And it wasn't long of showing buyers on a Saturday and doing all this stuff that agents do that I decided I didn't really want to do that full time. But I definitely, I work with buyers and sellers here and there, but I'm very selective in who I choose or if it's a referral, and I want to make sure that people are taken care of, but I don't want that to be my full-time gig.
Yeah. So. You actually did a podcast way early last year when I first launched the podcast and just spoke to that, you know, whether it makes sense for investors to get licensed or not. So it's an interesting topic because I get asked that a lot by new investors specifically. Hey, do I need to go get licensed? What are your thoughts on it? Do you think it's helped or hurt you as an investor?
I think it's absolutely helped me. I'm firmly in the camp of I'm glad I got it. I see the upside way more than the downside. Yes, I do have to disclose, you know, more than the average investor, you know, that I'm licensed and that I'm going to make money on the property and that kind of stuff. But at the same time, I feel like having the MLS access here in Colorado, I have instant tax record access across the state. And then when I do meet with sellers, I find it lends me credibility. As long as they don't just hate agents outright for some other reason, you know, I show up and I say, I'm actually governed by, you know, there's a state body that's above me that makes sure that I'm not screwing people over and I'm not, you know, and I'm actually doing things ethically. So screwing somebody over actually loses me more than, you know, just a slap on the wrist. I'd lose my license. I'd lose... excuse me, a big portion of my income, you know, and so, and then I use state contracts too. So I don't, you know, I just say these are available online for anybody to use and I'm not, there's nothing in there that's going to be a surprise. So, so for me, it's credibility and the tools that I use, far outweigh, you know, the non agent side of it, I guess.
That's interesting. Yeah. Cause people always get hung up on, you know, disclosure and whatnot, but like you said, maybe disclosing is a good thing if you can kind of go the credibility angle.
Yeah, definitely. I kind of just say I'm not, you know, I'm not just a guy operating out of his van. You know, I have an office address. Here it is. I'm licensed. You can look up to see if I have any complaints against me. You know, after 10 years in the business, you know, I have none. And so, you know, people look at that like kind of a Better Business Bureau thing. They go, oh, this guy's been doing this long enough and, you know, he has a good track record. And so it lends to the credibility without, you know, me having to sell myself so much. It's me plus, you know, hey, I'm licensed. I have this behind me. And if I do something wrong, that all goes away. So I'm incentivized to, you know, to be ethical, obviously.
That's a really interesting. Now, are you going on a lot of like seller lead calls? You're generating some sort of marketing, you're generating leads, and then you're going out there and talking with seller direct leads?
Yeah, I do all of that work. So okay. I do from marketing to go meet with people for sure.
So let's talk about that for a second. What does it look like to find a deal in Denver, especially being as competitive as it is for you?
So for me, it's definitely direct mail. direct marketing, networking, and referrals. So it's kind of those three things I hit pretty hard as often as possible. So, you know, direct mail looks like, for me, it looks like high quality, kind of handcrafted pieces that stand out from the competition. So when gurus are pitching yellow letters and handwritten pink postcards or whatever they are, right. I'm looking at that and I'm doing, you know, something completely different where I want to stand out, you know, to where I've, you know, sat down at the table with a seller and they're padding a stack of mail and there's four yellow letters, you know, three of the newest postcard that came out, and then my piece is sitting on top and it looks so different and it's high quality and like I said, handcrafted, so that it's, you know, stands out and so that they want to call me and not just, you know, it must be confusing to the average seller when they get, you know, the same exact marketing mm-hmm. from different people mm-hmm. to sell their house. Sure. It can only look like, you know, someone's trying to pull something over on them or it's a scam or something. So I try to not go down that route on any level. So
interesting. So just let us in on your secret sauce. what is some of your high quality copy look like?
So it's the copy is one thing. It's nothing special or new. You know, basically I make sure that it's handwritten, really handwritten, not really? Print, not printed out. And then, you know, I want to make sure that the envelope stands out and is crazy enough that somebody would open it 100% of the time. So if I sent you a letter and you saw this in your mailbox, you would go, yeah, what is this thing? And you would open it immediately. And so that alone, you know, those two things, you know, having a handwritten approach. And I also do a branded approach where my brand is visible. I'm not some anonymous dude. My website's on there. My my email address, my phone number, my actual business address is all on the things that I send, whether it's a letterhead or it's a something else. It's all there so that the seller can then go check me out. And it's funny because I'll send out a mailer and then I'll check my web statistics. And every time I send out a mailer, there's always, you know, a dozen people who have looked me up to see, you know, to legitimize it, saying, oh, sure, this is a real person. This is a real business. This is a legitimate operation. It's not just some person sending me a yellow letter or something. Mm-hmm.
So who's doing the handwriting? Is that somebody in your office?
Yeah, there's two people that I've hired to do, and that's all they do is handwriting. And so they're actually just people I found on Craigslist. And it's kind of funny because you would think that wouldn't be, you know, the sexiest job that you'd want. But, you know, I put an ad out there and it's kind of geared towards people with flexible time, as long as they get the, you know, 200 to 500 done in a week, then I don't care what they do with their time. And you know, I just pay them by the piece so they can be a mom who writes mm-hmm. while the baby sleeps, or be a college student and just write on their free time. And I had like 45 applicants in 2 days. I had to actually just take it down because I just had too many to mm-hmm. go through. So I picked and I talked to the best two. And these two ladies have been with me for about 6 months now, and they're cranking it. And I've seen a difference from when I used to print handwritten font to, you know, real pen on paper, and people can definitely tell the difference. So
what do you pay per piece? I'm just curious.
I pay 25 cents if they're just doing the letter, and then I think it's like 35 if they're also doing the envelope as well. So most of the time it is with the envelope. So about 35 cents a piece, and it takes, you know, just a couple of minutes to do one. So I think per hour they're actually probably making somewhere around $10 an hour, somewhere okay. in that.
Yeah, but you're paying for productivity rather than time, which I'm a huge advocate of.
Right. Yeah. So it just depends on, you know, how fast they want to do it. They can knock it out and enjoy the rest of their week and have some extra money, then good for them. So.
And then do they like bring it back by your office, like a stack that you then have to stamp and mail, or do they stamp them too?
Yeah, stamping is still on our side of the plate. So maybe I'll just have pay them a little bit extra to stamp them too. But
what are you finding is your response rate kind of going this route?
I'm one of those guys who don't track response rate all that much. I usually track more of deal rate. So if I'm nailing a certain list and I can look over time how many deals I've gotten out of that list, then I can kind of backwards track, you know, if this is still worth it. This list is good, this, you know, demographic or this area, combination of all those things. Response rate to me is, you have to count response rate for the guy who calls you and tell you to go jump off a cliff for sending a mail. Right. You know, that's one of your response rate. Yeah. And so that metric never really made sense. I'd rather say, am I getting deals from it or not? And how many, and is it worth it? Mm-hmm. And so I kind of track with those from the hip metrics, I guess.
In what lists are you hitting? What have you found it's produced for you in Denver?
So in Denver, I still like to get in the car and drive neighborhoods and see what's going on. So basically driving for dollars is still a good deal source for us. And then I try to get a combination of different lists. So if somebody's on like a tax list and a pre-foreclosure list, you know, that's somebody who I'll hit because they have more than one pain point, you know, that, or I guess area of motivation to an opportunity to help them. So they might be more motivated than if they were just on a pre-foreclosure list or just on the tax list. But if they're on both, you know, for example, so whether that's divorce or probate or tax or any of those things, you know, I'm not one of the guys who's trying to send out 10,000 pieces a month and just blanket the whole area. I'm trying to really nail down, you know, my best way to get a response and to get a deal, basically. So
yeah, no, that's good. I mean, highly, especially because your operation is primarily you, and I think your wife. It's not like you've got a whole team of people, so it makes sense. You don't want the phone ringing off the hook if it's just you. And if you can get a highly targeted list and hit the numbers you want and get the deals deep enough, then to me that makes a ton of sense. Now, I think you had mentioned before we got on that you're probably going to do about 10 flips this year, just yourself, without really a team behind you.
Yep.
Which is awesome. I mean, that's like almost one a month, you know, which can be great income for somebody. And honestly, for somebody who's just getting started out in fixing flips, I think that's the way to do it. I mean, you could sustain that for years and years on end of just doing one a month. And doing all the marketing, doing all the follow up, managing the, you know, a contractor if you needed to, and carve out a really good income for yourself. Is that kind of where you want to stay, or it just because you like the quality of life where you're at, or are you looking to grow to more volume? Where do you see yourself in a couple of years?
Yeah, so that's a great question. In for the longest time, I've been the lifestyle, you know, guy, and I can do, you know, I can do less than 10 flips and be just more than comfortable. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was, you know, my wife was staying home with our son and up until he went to kindergarten last year. And so it was like, I want to be there to do all the fun things and go all the fun places and not be tied down by a, you know, business that takes up so much of my time that it's, you know, you kind of wonder, why am I doing this when I would rather be, you know, at the park or enjoying life with, you know, kids while they're young. And so for the longest time, it was all about lifestyle, all about, you know, we can afford the things that we want and we can save up for what we want and we can do all the things that we want and but not be nailed down for 80 hours a week. And so now my son's in school full time and meeting, you know, awesome people like you and Brandon and, you know, a lot of different people have got me to change my mind to, yes, I can scale up, but I can scale up smart and actually still enjoy my time, you know, enjoy this lifestyle, but actually scale up and be able to, you know, build up rentals, build up, you know, basically whatever I want, but doing it the smart way. I always thought it was, you know, kind of a heart attack thinking about seven people in the office that you have to, you know, show up every day and pay. But thankfully, guys like you have kind of changed my mind. So in about 3 to 5 years, I see myself doing actually more flips than we're doing now. Hopefully about 24 or so a year. Mm-hmm. Add in about the same amount of wholesale deals. And then actually, I've been getting my butt kicked lately from friends and mentors about actually getting more into buy and hold. And I know that you're in that arena and probably somebody who's going to be kicking my butt soon too. But, you know, definitely it's time. After 10 years of the quick money, it's time to take that quick money and throw it into things that make a lot more sense, which is, you know, longer term buy and hold stuff.
Yeah. Well, you said right. The quick money, it's the money you live on, but you're also hopefully putting money away, you're saving, you're doing something with it. You got to reinvest it for the long term, whether it's in rentals or notes or something. Absolutely. Yeah, you don't want to just be turning enough houses to live on. You got to be planning for the future as well.
Right. Yeah, and that's been a big paradigm shift, just like Rich Dad Poor Dad changed my mind. For the longest time I thought, you know, I was like, well, maybe in, you know, 5 or 10 years, I'll buy some rentals and then that'll be my retirement. And I'll, you know, live happily ever after. But, you know, it's been a lot of smarter people than me around me have been saying, you know, long enough. They're like, hey, now that you're doing this and you're, you know, your marketing is hitting and you're doing all these things, now it's time to start investing that for the long term. And now I'm finally listening. So it takes me a little bit, but I'll get there eventually.
You're getting there. Well, the good thing is you've carved out a good business. You know your market. You know how to get deals. For you, now you're at the point where you just systematize what you're already doing and plug the right people in. It's really not that complicated once you've sort of figured out your local market. And you've already got some cool ways of drumming up deals. You're probably already pretty well networked. You know, you hire one at a time and plug them into the right positions, and next thing you know, you're doing, you know, 50 deals a year.
Yeah, exactly. That's the shift of letting go of pieces of the business that need to be let go so that somebody else can handle them, so then I can work on something that is on my business instead of in my business every day.
Absolutely. So. Well, so you've been at this 10, almost 11 years, fairly full time. Is there one deal, you know, in Arizona or in Colorado that stands out to you as like your best deal ever?
Yeah, there's definitely one that that I really like, and it has to do with you know, the way it stands out is at least our philosophy is that we try to, you know, help people first and then go from there. So, you know, dealing with a lot of distressed real estate, we deal with a lot of obviously just, you know, crazy issues. Mm-hmm. And so probably one of my favorite deals was it was a door knocking lead that my partner took. He went out and just was door knocking in this one neighborhood one day. And, you know, this nice old lady comes out from the back of the house, which was strange. And, you know, they got to talking and she was going into foreclosure and she was, you know, kind of hesitant to let my partner in the house and, you know, kind of take a look around once they had decided that she wanted to sell to us. And so she's like, oh, I have a few things, you know, here and there. It's a bit messy. You don't want to go in there and, you know, let me clean up. And so my partner left and, you know, was calling her and coming by and, you know, she was just wasn't letting him in the house. And he's kind of like, just finally, you know, we have to get in to see it. Otherwise, you know, there's not much we can do. So finally, you know, we got in touch with her sister, and her sister was pretty much more real about it. She's like, no, this house is like to the waist of hoarder. You know, it's like just so much stuff in there. And so she convinced her sister to let us in. And sure enough, this place is probably the worst place I've ever set foot in. Wow. But, you know, it's just one of those things where, you know, you can't judge someone for the way that they live. You're there to help them. And so we said, you know, this is fine. We've dealt with stuff like this before. And, you know, kind of going through it and figuring out what we needed to do to help her. We were getting her some dumpsters if she wanted to start cleaning it out, Or finally, it ended up to be after, you know, after pushing off the sale a few weeks to give her time to, you know, do something, we finally realized that there's just no way that she's going to be able to get to even, you know, 5% of this stuff. And so we offered her, and it was, you know, it was the trash type of hoarder, so it wasn't like a bunch of valuable stuff in there. So she said, we finally agreed to say, hey, let's, you can just sell us the house as is. We'll take care of everything. And if there's anything in there that you want to keep, you know, it's yours. But, you know, we'll take care of this so that you don't have to go through foreclosure and then get kicked out. This way you can actually have some money to walk with and go from there. So she was extremely happy with that. She moved on to, I think she actually ended up moving in with her sister. And, you know, finally we get in there and it was like, you know, 5 or 6 dumpsters full of stuff. It was you know, it was cats, and it was one of those, you know, dead cat in the attic, dead cat in the basement houses. And the transformation was the second favorite part of that was, you know, I thought with 10 or 12 cats living there that there was no possible way. Like, I would have put money on it that we couldn't get the smell out of there. And after taking out a bunch of drywall and using about 25 gallons of kills throughout the whole house, we actually changed out all the air ducting too. We don't usually do that, but we pretty much had to on this one. So the furnace was new, the air ducting was new, you know, all of the insulation was new, and a bunch of new drywall. And the finished product was incredible. You know, I would bring people through there and see if it was just me, but you know, they couldn't smell anything. You couldn't tell it was a hoarder house. We made, you know, we changed this lady's life and helped her out, and then we also changed and helped the neighborhood too with this house, turning it into something really nice. And we made a good deal of money on it too. So it was a win-win-win for us, for her, and for the neighborhood. And I always tell this story because it's basically kind of the gist of what we do. We try to help people, you know, we try to help neighborhoods, and we are obviously here to also make money. So
sure. Well, and I've always said that, I mean, as long as I've been in business, the ultimate goal in any transaction is that all parties at the closing table feel like they won, that it
right.
truly is a win-win situation. And you're right. In a lot of these situations where you got a motivated seller, you're solving a problem for them, and they are relieved to get the house sold or for you to solve their problem, whatever that looks like. And in the process, hopefully, you know, you're making a profit, but you're also doing good. You know, you almost never hear of a neighbor that's upset that an investor came in and fixed up a house, because all you're doing, you're bringing up the values in the neighborhood. And,
exactly.
We actually have a hoarder down the street from us, and she's not doing anything for our home values.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody came in there, bought her house and fixed it up, I'd have no problem with that. I think
that's fantastic. Great. Like, so, even if I don't get that deal, yeah, it doesn't matter. Like,
exactly. Let's fix that thing up.
Let's help everybody.
Right. Well, and honestly, as an investor too, really, the uglier the house, typically I just see dollar signs, because I know there's a lot of upside potential. You can usually get those things deeply discounted, and that's where you carve out the most margin in most cases, are those really ugly ones.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
We've done a couple hoarder houses. We did one actually where it was so bad that we were waiting for it was actually one of the relatives living in the house, and they couldn't get him out. And so we were waiting to buy it, honestly, for them to get the relative out. And ultimately, a couple months later, the relative died in the house.
Oh, no.
And they think it was from black widows, because there were so many. It was just so atrocious inside.
Oh, my gosh. That is insane. I love hearing those stories, then how those people were also helped out. Because every story is different. Every deal is different. But man, some of these things that we run into are like, you just write a book about it.
You really could. You almost should have a book, you know, where you just interview a bunch of investors and just get their craziest stories. Because there's so many crazy stories. And everybody's got one.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it'd be crazy. That's, I've had that idea before, but
you should run with it. Hey, this is a good segue. So you are actually in the process of writing a book right now that's going to get published in conjunction with Bigger Pockets. What's the name of the book?
The book is The Book on Finding and Funding Great Deals. And yeah, like you said, it is going to be published through the Bigger Pockets publishing
Gotcha. And that's so they'll probably be found on their site. When is that going to be published, do you think? How far out are we?
We still got some work to do, but we're looking at towards the end of the year, maybe late October, I think is what I was last told. So, okay. Yeah.
That's awesome, man. It's going to be great.
It's going to be, I had a good time putting all of these things down onto paper, and then the whole process of editing it and making it, you know, make sense. And somebody else kind of took my writing style and edited it so it's appropriate for everybody. And it's a cool platform and a great subject as well.
Oh yeah, people are absolutely going to. It sounds like to me you've got a lot of really good local knowledge, but even just insights into how to find deals. So to put that into a book, and then even how to fund deals. People are always asking how they fund deals. I mean, that's going to be highly demand. So
for sure,
Anton, I appreciate you coming on the show, man. This was a really good podcast. I look forward to actually you and I on the side are doing some masterminds together. So I look forward to talking with you more and helping each other out in our businesses.
Yeah, absolutely. I have enjoyed getting to know you and your business, and I'm looking forward to getting to know you more.
Awesome. Anton, take care, buddy.
You too, man.
All right. Hey folks, it's Ken again, and I want to talk to you for just a quick second about becoming a private lender with our company, Georgia Residential Partners. If you've got money right now sitting on the sidelines, maybe it's in a bank account earning less than 1%, or maybe it's in the stock market and you're worried about where the stock market is headed, you might want to consider becoming a private lender with our company. Where you might be getting 1% to 2% on a CD or a money market account right now, when you become a private lender with us, you're actually well into the double digits in terms of return on investment. Again, if you've got money that's not working for you right now, it's sitting on the sidelines, and you want to get it into investment that's safe, that's passive, and has the opportunity to get you well into the double digits, please reach out to me. You can actually contact us through our website at dealfarm.net. Go to the Contact Us page. It goes right into my inbox, and I will reply and set up a time to talk. Thanks so much for listening to The Deal Farm. We'll see you on the next episode. Take care.